Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashai, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, we bow to all of you. Divine Mother, we are thy children, naughty or good, we are thine. Thou must reveal thyself to us. Help us to give thy love to all whom we meet. Om, peace. Amen. Please be seated. Well, today I will read from Conversations with Yogananda. What is the difference, asked the professor, between science and religion in the search for truth? True religion, the master replied, is not theology. It is born of deep inner communion with God. True religion teaches us, for example, how to become the atom, whereas theology at most only discusses the atom. Science studies the nature of the atom outwardly, proving its existence by experimentation. Inner religion, however, goes beyond experimentation to actual experience. It helps one to cognize by direct experience his oneness with the atom at its vital center. Now, in these simple words, we have a very deep teaching. There's been sort of a dance between religion and science for many centuries now. Religion taught people to believe. This was the definition of a Christian. Credo, I believe. And if you look at just plain facts, for example, people used to believe that the world is flat. You go outdoors, you look at it, it looks flat. But on the other hand, if you go out at sea and see a ship approaching from the distance, the first thing you see is its mast. And then gradually the ship all comes up. But obviously, there's a curve there that has come up over. The fact is that now we know that the world is not flat but round. Many things people believe were not true just because they believed them. Belief doesn't make for truth. So when Galileo and others came on the scene and said, let's only look into those truths which we can prove, they set science apart from God. They separated it by saying that we can only ask questions relating to movement, mass, weight, such things as you could prove outwardly. And so it set science against religion. And pretty soon, although they began only by saying we can't know whether there's a God or not, science says there is no God. And so there has been this division between science and religion that has lasted for some centuries. Now it's interesting to find that science is beginning to come in the direction of religion. The subtler science of quantum physics and so on are taking people more and more, as Sir James Jeans said at the beginning of the last century, or I should say early in the last century, that is beginning to look more and more as if matter is not only energy instead of being solid matter, but that that energy is really a manifestation of consciousness. And so religion and science now are beginning to have sort of a dance together. And on the one hand, religion is beginning to think in terms more of how can we experience this truth. There have been people in religion who have come to this understanding on their own. I remember when I was a young man, before I read Autobiography of a Yogi, I was in a deep search for truth. And I desperately wanted to know what life is all about. I didn't believe in God. I didn't disbelieve in him. But the God that I had been talked about at, shown, was something I couldn't accept. Somebody who would condemn people for ignorance. I mean, let's face it, God put us in a position to err if we possibly can. He put us, first of all, we have to put out energy to create our bodies in the mother's womb. Then we have to put out energy to eat. We have to put out energy to run and walk. And we have to put out energy to become complete human beings. And so gradually we find all our energy perforce. We have no choice but to go outward into the world. This creates a bias. And all our movement, therefore, from then on, tends to be outward. And being outward, it goes through the senses, and therefore its first pleasures will be sensory ones. Drinking, eating, and it moves forward into all the different delusions that people can get into when their energy does go outward. They think their happiness will lie in things. They think that the more famous they are, the happier they'll be, the more fulfilled. The richer they are, the more fulfilled they will be. The more they can enjoy physical pleasures and comforts, the happier they will be. Nobody thinks inwardly. But I remember when I was seeking truth, I thought there's got to be some underlying reality. And I was seeking truth in every way I could possibly imagine. I wanted to be an astronomer to begin with. And I think what drew me to astronomy was the fact that it was so vast, so inspiring in its vastness. But I finally realized that it's really based on facts, and facts don't satisfy. You can have 100 billion galaxies, or just one galaxy, or just a handful of stars around our own star, the sun. And it would make no difference to you or me. Science doesn't have to satisfy the heart. And I thought, well, this has to, I've got to go further than this. There's got to be some way of finding a truth that will affect man. Excuse me. And so, I began seeking through political systems. And I toyed with communism and socialism and this-ism and that-ism. And I realized that nothing really is going to change us. Systems cannot make people different. And rather, people can abuse systems. Communism, which in the ideal is a beautiful thing, in practice becomes an ugly thing, almost a satanic thing in its total rejection of every high ideal. And so I turned away from scientific or political systems to try to find truth in the arts. And I sought it through music, through painting, through different things. Nothing really satisfied. I wanted to be a playwright and a poet. And I thought, well, how many people's lives have been changed by even somebody so great as Shakespeare? Very few. You go to a play, you come back, you forget about it. It's not enough. And I wanted something that would help all of mankind, help them all to find something that they wanted inside. I early decided that the thing that everybody in the world is really seeking is joy. And these things cannot give you that joy. So I thought, well, maybe it's something wrong with me. I really seriously began to wonder if I was going crazy. How many people, I thought, have asked themselves these questions? And so I thought, maybe what I need to do is get out in the country and be with simple country folk and enjoy the beauties of nature, and everything will be beautiful. So I went upstate New York to a little town called Indian Village. And I went out into the forest and looked at the dewdrop on a leaf. And I thought, yes, that's beautiful, but I can't feel it. What's the matter with me? I'm like a motor running on one cylinder. And then I found that not only that, but nature also had things like flies, deer flies, all those happy things we experience when we go out into nature. And I realized that this is not enough. It's me that I've got to change. When I mixed with the country folk, I found them just as stupid as the people in the cities. Many of them much more so. And so I decided that even if I'm going crazy, I must know what God is. I remember one night I went out into the countryside outside Charleston, South Carolina, where I had gone to study playwriting. And I thought, if there's a God, what must he be? And I thought, well, he can't be a policeman up there or a judge waiting to clap us into prison for succumbing to temptations he himself has thrown at us. That's just not fair. And I thought, no, he can't be a man like that. He has to be consciousness. And I had read that consciousness is a product of the brain. That means that we're like robots, programmed to do everything. I thought, well, you can program a robot possibly to eat, but you can't program any robot to ask questions like these. So I realized that I am conscious, but my consciousness is more than in my brain. I don't produce consciousness, I manifest it. And I realized that God has to be consciousness. If nothing else, he has to be consciousness. And I and my awareness have to be a part of that. And if that's true, then I find this true to be true in my life also, that the more in tune I am with that greater consciousness, the more clear my mind becomes, the more happy I become, and the more out of tune I am, the less happy I am, the less expanded, the more contracted and petty. And I realize that those things which helped me to be clear in my mind, like living rightly, were things that brought me closer to fulfillment. Whereas if I got drunk, I did not find fulfillment. I found a hangover. And so I thought, well, then there can only be one purpose in life, and that is to realize God. And I didn't know what it meant. I did, as I said, wonder if I was going crazy. But finally, I reached the point where I decided that even if I go crazy, I've got to do this. There can be no other answer. And I remember, as Haridas was just telling you, I was in New York. My parents, we lived in Scarsdale, and my mother at this time, we'd rented our house out in Scarsdale because my father had been sent to Cairo, to Egypt, to seek oil there. He was an oil geologist. And the day that I put my mother on the ship, I came uptown New York and I went to a little store, a bookstore, Doubleday Duran on Fifth Avenue. And there I found Autobiography of a Yogi. To make a long story short, he's already told you the story. I took the next bus across the country. I saw this picture of Yogananda on the cover, and it was so attractive and so familiar. And I went 4 days and 4 nights all the way across the country. And when I first came, I had landed in Encinitas. And Sister Ganamata met me. And I told her that I wanted to be a disciple. And she was testing me. She said, but have you just studied the lessons? I didn't know they had lessons. I didn't know they had an organization. I just knew that I wanted to meet Yogananda and be accepted. So anyway, she said that you can't possibly join until you have taken the lessons. And I became very indignant at her. But I didn't realize who she was. But a very interesting thing occurred. She said that Yogananda was lecturing at the church up in Hollywood. And as I was on the bus and again waxing indignant in my mind against this presumption of this old woman, I suddenly remembered her eyes. And I thought, well, those eyes are very, there's a lot of wisdom in them. And I asked for forgiveness for misjudging her like that. And suddenly, I knew that I was accepted. How, I don't know. But I came to the church, and they told me that you can't possibly see him. His appointments are booked for 2.5 months. And I thought, first, I can't take the lessons for 4 years. And I can't join until I've taken the lessons for 4 years. Now I can't even meet the man for 2.5 months. I was desperate. And I thought, I've just got to meet him. I was really like an overripe fruit, ready to fall from the tree. And I went out the door thinking, well, if I have to, I have to. I'll just have to be humble for a change. And I thought of going and living in the Hollywood Hills and coming to services and waiting till I could meet him. And as the moment I came to the door, I had just stepped outside the door, or was just about to do so, when the secretary came up from behind and she said, since you've come from such a distance, I will ask the master if he'll see you now. And she came back a few moments later and said, Master, we'll see you. So he told me, I want you to know that I'm not seeing you because you've come from such a distance. 2 weeks ago, a woman flew all the way from Sweden, and I wouldn't see her because Divine Mother didn't tell me to. He said, I only do what Divine Mother tells me to, and she told me to see you. That's why I'm seeing you. And so the first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. I had never dreamed I would say such words to anyone, but I knew in my heart I desperately needed help. And through his help, I've gained whatever little bit I've gained in life. But to me, it's a great deal. I'm very grateful for having met him. I'm very grateful for the years of training he gave me and for a teaching that finally, of all the different philosophies I've ever read, studied, heard about, it's the only one that makes absolute sense to me. It's not an exclusive philosophy. And there's another thing that I had against religion, was its exclusivity. If you don't believe in Jesus Christ just the way I believe in him, then you'll go to hell. I thought, this is nonsense. I just couldn't accept that kind of religion. But he said that all roads lead to God. All different beliefs, everything leads finally to that one realization. Now, between that kind of religion and true science, there is no difference. But let's examine science for a moment and ask ourselves, is science really that objective? You know, when Emanuel Velikovsky, he said that he came up with various theories that simply didn't match the beliefs of modern science. He said that Venus, for example, was pulled out of Jupiter by a passing comet, and that's why you have that big red hole or whatever it is on Jupiter. Well, you know that many book publishers wouldn't accept the publication of his books for them because the scientists had threatened to boycott any publisher that would publish his books. Is this scientific? I have found that scientists can be just as dogmatic as the most fundamental Christian. They're so sure of themselves and of what they know. They're so sure that matter is the whole basis of everything. Even though science and, you know, Max Planck, the famous scientist in Germany, said that a new scientific concept or discovery doesn't gain acceptance because it's logical. It gains acceptance because the old guard die off. And the young ones grow up used to the idea. But human nature is dogmatic, and it tends to assert its own beliefs. And you can call yourself a scientist, but you're just as much of a bigot as a religious until you understand the importance of experience. Scientists, in fact, are usually more open than most religionists. But it needn't be so, and it isn't so. I've met many religionists who are open to anything that is, whatever is. I remember I was with Ananda Moyi Ma, who was a great woman saint in India, and I spent a great deal of time with her. She was a great inspiration to me. When I met Master, I always held him in a certain amount of awe. But with her, it was like being with my mother. So I always remained completely loyal to Master, but I had great love for her. Anyway, one time, I was staying in a cave in the Himalayas and on the Ganges, and it's called Vashishta Guha, which means this cave where the ancient Rishi Vashishta used to live. And I was wondering to her if it could be that. And after all, over a period of time, the water flows and digs deeper and deeper into the earth, whereas this cave is just almost on the level of the Ganges itself. And I remember saying to her that that's an argument against it. And although there's a strong belief in India that Vashishta did live there, she paused a moment. She said, "Tikata bolicho, you said the right words. This is true. Saints are willing to listen to opposing points of view." And I have seen that again and again. Master was open to everything, but yet he already knew so much. He knew everything, really. So the difference between science and religion is simply that science emphasizes experience. And if you can get away from human nature and its dogmatism, science has advanced because of this desire to know from experience. The only thing is that science will never reach a final truth. And every 10 years or so, some basic scientific dogma is put aside in favor of another one. And it will go on and on that way, because it doesn't go to the heart of things. When God created the universe, he didn't do it the way we create things. We create a statue by taking a block of stone, chipping away at it, till finally it takes the form of a human being. But God creates everything from the inside out. He becomes the seed, and the seed becomes the tree. He becomes the atom, and the atom gradually coalesces with other atoms and forms of different shapes in the universe. But everything is, as Master said, center everywhere, circumference nowhere. This is the beauty of true spiritual science, you might say. Because the spiritual scientist says, "I want to know from my own experience." Like that story in Autobiography of a Yogi where Sri Yukteswar tells Yogananda that his mother said to him once when he was a boy, "Don't go in that closet because there's a ghost in there." Probably she didn't want him to mess about with things in the closet. But as soon as he said that he was a ghost, he said, "Well, let me go and find out." So that was his draw. Well, this is the right attitude. A true seeker of truth will examine everything, and particularly he will examine those things which opposes beliefs, because he wants to know from his experience. So if you're really seeking truth, don't be afraid of challenges. Somebody said to Master something about this. Master said, "Truth is not afraid of challenges." Challenge your own beliefs. Never say that I know this is true until you have experienced it. But the more you feel this knowledge welling up within you, the more you'll come to the point where you know that you are this truth. You'll find that behind every atom there is consciousness. An amazing thing Master used to say is that God is, this was said first by Swami Shankaracharya. What's amazing is Master's translation of that. Usually people just say Satchitananda, which is the nature of God, according to Shankara, is Satchitananda. And usually the translation of that is written as existence, consciousness, bliss. Doesn't mean anything when you put it that way. But Master said, ever existing, ever conscious, and a beautiful new thought he introduced, ever new joy. Ever new joy. How can joy be ever new? He said that every atom is dowered with individuality. This is an incredible thing, that when you see every person in this world, everybody is different. What God has been able to do with two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, it's just unbelievable. Everybody is different somehow. And if we look at every human being, everybody is seeking. I remember this was an experience I had in a hotel room in Florence, Italy, just a few months ago. I was seeing in my dream all sorts of people, and I knew that what everyone was seeking in that dream, regardless of his expressions, regardless of the hardness of his materialism or whatever it might be, everybody was seeking the same thing, bliss. This is our nature. We've come from bliss. But the other beautiful thing in that was that everybody expressed that bliss and that search for bliss differently. Bliss is also ever new. That it's different in every human being. It's different from moment to moment. The inconceivable nature of such a divine consciousness is really beyond imagination. But I remember in my dream waking up and thinking, that is why we should love everybody. Because they're all seeking the same things. They're all seeking the same thing, that bliss. And I remember I was looking for some paper to write this down on because it was such a glorious thought. And I couldn't find any. The hotel didn't provide it to us, which usually they do, but they'd forgotten to. I didn't have any paper in my suitcase. And finally I found a little paper doily under a glass. And I wrote everything down as I possibly could. But it was really a high point in my life. To realize the reason I should love everybody and do love everybody is that we're all seeking, even the worst mafioso is seeking bliss. The only thing is he doesn't know it, that's all. He thinks he'll find it through power, through revenge, through money, through all sorts of worldly things. And he doesn't find it. And so it is that you keep running down the trail looking after this thing and that thing, and in the end you don't find it. It's sort of like a story. I've told this story many times, so if you've heard it before, don't yawn, just wait. But it's a story about a U.S. Army camp where they were training young men to be soldiers in the Second World War. And this young man was picking up papers off the ground, throwing them down. This isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. Finally, people seeing him doing nothing but this recommended that he go to the camp psychiatrist. So he went to the psychiatrist and he took up pieces of paper from the desk and so on. This isn't it. This isn't it. Couldn't even get him to say anything else. So finally, he recommended him for a medical discharge. And as soon as he got that discharge, he said, "This is it." And so we go around in this world thinking we'll find it through sex, through power, through money, through fame, through
all the things that people look for, and they find that they don't get what they want. It isn't what they wanted. Once you have it, it suddenly turns to ashes. And all that beautiful gold that you pick up, it suddenly turns to ashes. Nothing gives you what you want. And so it is that it's important and, in fact, essential to believe in reincarnation, because nobody could achieve freedom even from one bad habit in just one lifetime. It takes a long time. But over many, many, many incarnations, how many? Well, I almost tremble to say so, but maybe days of Brahma. Because you come into this world, and it says in the Gita and also in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which is a great scripture, incidentally. It is not just a love poem. It's all symbolic. But Yogananda wrote a wonderful explanation of that, and I put it out in book form. I edited it, and it's called the Rubaiyat Explained by Paramhansa Yogananda. But in both that and in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that when people in this world is created, when the universe is created, all these souls are thrown out, and at the end of a day of Brahma, which lasts for some billions of years, the most souls go back into the quiescent state and then come out again in another day of Brahma. And how long it takes, you know, to reach the human level takes 5 to 8 million lives. But once you've reached the human level, then until that point you're pushed upward. But once you reach the human level, you have the free will to go forward or backward. And you can go backward as far as you want to if you do the wrong things. People can go back, even, this is something that horrified me when I first read it, but Master said, even to the level of a germ. Just think of the pain of having reached a level of high awareness and then being stuck in that tiny, tiny, ignorant body of a germ. Yet it happens sometimes. It's a frightening journey we're on, in the sense that if you make mistakes, you can make them as long as you want and go as far down as you want. And it's not that you remember having been Joe Green, but you remember that you were more than this. And the sense of suffering at that stage is not very pleasant. Yeah, there's plenty to frighten you into seeking God too. But the truth is that once you do find Him, once you've thrown away your last bit of paper and found the one that you were looking for, then you feel such fulfillment, such a thrill. No one who has ever sought God has ever said, what a scam. They've always said it was worth every moment of it to find this bliss. It's so absolute, so complete, so all-embracing. When, you know, if it weren't for the existence of saints in this world, of great masters who have come here to help us to get up there and be with them, if it weren't for them, it would look like an absolutely hopeless task. But we know from their experience, and we know from our own, because the more we turn in that direction, the more we feel blissful in ourselves too. But in the end, when you finally reach that level of absolute freedom, and you can reach it in this lifetime, it's not a difficult thing to reach. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, in a sense, because of course it takes all the strength you've got. And yet, once you realize what the gain is, your little strength is a very small thing compared to that. You can do it in this lifetime if you really put your mind to it. But once I asked Master, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? He answered, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. And I didn't want to think I was the only laggard. So I said, well, sir, does it always take so long? He said, oh, yes. Desires for name and fame and this and that take them away again and again. And I suppose that he mentioned name and fame because those were my problems. Maybe I wanted name and fame, I don't know. But nonetheless, we've all had something to fight. And when we realize that the only thing worth seeking is his pleasure, his acceptance. I've never been nervous as a lecturer because I felt people don't know much anyway. So what does their good opinion of me matter? But at the same time, I felt that I want to give. I don't care what they think of me. I want to give to them. In that attitude, you don't worry about what people think of you. So the more you share with people, always your attitude should be one of giving, of sharing, not thinking in terms of what's in it for me, like that rat in the Charlotte's Web movie, "What's in it for me, Charlotte?" Well, you don't want to think that way anymore. Think rather, what can I give to people? How can I make them happy too? This has been really my motivation all my life. I've never cared for money or recognition or anything, but I have had this really intense desire to see everybody in the world feeling blissful. And this has been my motivation, even in coming to Master, as I was crossing the country and I was thinking that if this is such a great teaching, I want everyone in the world to know it. That's why he singled me out among his disciples and kept telling me, you have a great work to do, and urging me to understand that I was to carry forward his teaching to others. And this has been my job in life. When I was thrown out of SRF, it was really the greatest blessing that ever happened to me, because it made me free to serve him without feeling that I had to serve an organization. And I could serve him the way he had told me to do. I could never have done that within the organization. But it was a great blessing, because in this way, I don't have to worry about what I'm supposed to say. I can talk from my heart. It's been the most wonderful experience. I've been doing this now for just about a little over 62 years. And it's only become better and better and better. Now often I feel so much bliss that it's hard to bear. But this bliss is something I want everyone to know. Everybody is made from that bliss. Everybody is an expression of that bliss. And the more you feel complete in yourself, the more you will find what you yourself are looking for. So this is scientific, in the sense that it's based on experience, and it is religious because it aspires to God. And science usually tries to put God out of the picture and seek only a truth that they can grasp with their own mind. Religion has this difference. You know, in the teaching of yoga, they say, yoga citta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the neutralization of the vrittis, or whirlpools, eddies, of feeling. Feeling is the essence of consciousness. Reason analyzes, reason watches, feeling identifies with. It's your feelings that need to be uplifted. When I came to Master, I was very intellectual, and he kept telling me, get devotion, get devotion. So I worked on it until I finally found that that's the only thing worth having. When you feel in your heart, then you know what it is you really want. So true science has to include the heart, and true science doesn't include the heart. Therefore, I say that science without religion, science without high aspiration, science that always says, oh, it's only this, it's only that, it doesn't give you the truth that you're looking for. Religion in churches and so on, that doesn't give you what you're looking for. But seek that God within your own self. I was lecturing in Australia some years ago, and somebody said to me after a talk of mine, he said, well, I heard what you had to say about God. What do you have to say to me? I'm an atheist, as they put it.
And
he said, what can you say about God that I could accept? And I said to him, why don't you think of God as the highest potential you can imagine for yourself? And he said, well, yeah, I can live with that.
But
just don't say, you don't have to believe in God. You don't know what you're believing in anyway. But if you believe in your own self, in that part of you which longs for something more, that gives you a touch. We can only touch on God as far as we ourselves have understood of life and what it's all about. So if you're thinking of bliss, think of God as that bliss. Sooner or later, you'll come to the point where you become one with Him. And then you will realize that you have never been any different from Jesus Christ, from Buddha, from Krishna, from all the great masters who ever lived. You are that. I remember one time when I was a young man, my guru told me to grow a beard. And I said, sir, do you mean it? Nobody in those days grew beards. But he said, yes, try it. And I remember the first time I had been growing this beard for some months. And, you know, it can be, you have to look a little shaggy by that time. And my parents were coming, so he had me sit down. He brought out a pair of scissors and cut my beard himself. And he was laughing and chuckling all the time. But he wanted it to keep this length, and so that's the length I've always kept it. But the experience of having a beard was such that people used to think I looked like Jesus Christ. And Master mentioned this one time, and I said to him, well, sir, I'd rather be like Jesus Christ than look like him. And Master said, that will come. He saw all of us as potential Christs. He always saw each one of us as potentially divine. That wonderful thing that I saw about him that moved me really sometimes almost to tears was the deep respect he showed to everyone. I remember after one function, there was some Indian man who was sort of a little tipsy, and he put his arms around him like this, and the master just took it very calmly, and one Bengali student of his spoke to him in Bengali. This other Indian wasn't Bengali, and said something derogatory. I didn't know Bengali then myself. And master said, don't. The man had the dignity of a child of God. And so he saw each one of us. He had that kind of respect for us, which you would not expect in a teacher of his level of wisdom. But he saw in each one of us that potential divine which he himself had attained. You must have that kind of faith in yourself. When you go to the mirror in the morning and you look at yourself and that's not you. You aren't that person. You aren't that person who's an American, a man or a woman, rich, poor, all the different characteristics that you think define you. Get rid of your self-definitions. The entire spiritual path is a process of getting rid of self-definitions, of thinking that I am this or that. You are everything. You are that potential at your own heart center that can become everything. You are God. Except you can't say that the wave is the ocean. But you can say that the ocean has become all of its waves. So let that ocean become you. I remember one time I was sitting at Master's feet, and he was sitting in a chair and editing his Bhagavad Gita commentaries. And I was thinking, what a wonderful thing it is to be his disciple. And I remember he finished his editing and asked me to help him stand up. Then he looked at me just about this close to me, deeply in the eyes, and he said, just a bulge of the ocean. That's all he was. He wanted me to see him not as Yogananda, but as an expression of God. And that is why I loved him, because I love God. And that's why I loved God, because I loved him. He came to help us to see who we are in our own potential. When you've reached that, you go beyond science, you go beyond religion, you come into wisdom, which is the culmination of all truth-seeking. The more you have of that, the more you have of what you yourself most deeply want. So, I would like to ask if you have questions. And because I'm deaf as a post, Jyotish will have to help you with, help me, I should say, by answering your questions. So, please ask any questions you have. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, do stand when you ask a question.
Okay, yeah. Now, Mike, oh.
Thank you, Swami, for a beautiful talk. On the subject of potential, there are so many potential movements out there. And sometimes, how does one know when you've reached that expression of your fullest potential? You've mentioned words such as
Yogananda was asked that question by the same professor who I quoted in this reading today. And he said, is there any end to evolution? Master's answer was beautiful. He said, no end. You go on until you achieve endlessness. It embraces everything. Mm-hmm. And how do you know it? Well, there's nothing more to know when you know that.
I see. Sometimes I may feel a little guilty that I'm not there yet. How does one handle any internal feelings like that?
And as much as that's a feeling all of us have, I think we can say that you have to assume that you're not perfect until you stop asking that question. Any other questions?
Hi. Is this on? While I was listening to your talk, I was feeling very, very connected and very peaceful and very calm. As if I was.
I'm grateful.
And very, I don't feel that way very often. So what's the quickest way that I can, when I'm not around you, when I'm not listening to you, helping me feel this way, connected to like almost everybody in this room and everybody in this planet, when I'm not around you, how can I feel this connected to everything?
Well, it wouldn't hurt to think of when you are around me. You know, I pray always that people not get my talks only with their minds, but get them with their hearts. So I'm glad that you do feel that. But the main thing is that you have to understand that you are that. And the more that you live in inner peace, the more you will achieve that. The way is by meditation. Prayer is talking to God. Meditation is listening for his answer. And the more you listen, the more you begin to feel him talking to you and through you. So this comes by not only just sitting silent, but certain techniques help you to it. The purpose of yoga techniques is not to force God to come to you. Many people make that mistake. What it does is you've got the sunlight on the side of a building, and some of the rooms have their curtains drawn shut. The sunlight is always there. Your job is to open those curtains. So yoga helps to calm your mind so that you can listen. You can't listen if you close your eyes, try to meditate, and let your mind go chattering on. Kriya Yoga is a fantastic technique, partly because it really deals with the science of inner awakening. When you seek truth, when you go to higher states of consciousness, there's actually a level in your own body where the energy becomes centered. I remember once, many years ago, I was just a young man on the path, and I fell into a deep mood one day. And as long as I was in this mood, all my thoughts kept supporting that mood, supporting why I should be in a mood. And so I asked my mental citizens, do you like being in this mood? And they said, no, we don't like it. So I said, well, boys, what are we going to do about it? And so they all said, well, let's try changing our level of consciousness. So I sat down and meditated and put my mind here. And this is a center for concentration. You know, whenever you think deeply, you tend to knit your eyebrows. So putting my mind here, 5 minutes was all it took. I suddenly found myself on a different level, and all my thoughts were positive. So it always depends on your level of consciousness. This is where yoga makes a science of these things. As your mind goes down, it goes into darkness. As the mind comes up, it goes toward light. And yoga techniques, and Kriya Yoga especially, help to bring that consciousness up from the body awareness to enlightenment, which comes when your conscience is centered here. And then from this center, when you can open this up, then you go to the top of the head, which is known in yoga as the Sahasrara. But Yogananda said that there have not been saints in the West compared to those great yogis, because they knew how to get there. Most saints, it's sort of like a hose. You've got water going through the hose. If you turn it on too quickly, the hose will thrash about and maybe even break the sides of it. And so many Christian saints have had to go through intense suffering because they didn't know what they had to do. And that greater energy that came in as they meditated. There, I remember the story of this one saint who was feeling such heat all over his body, he jumped into a pool and the whole pool evaporated from that heat. Well, these are things that saints have to go through. If they don't know where that huge energy coming from God goes. So there are two things to do with a hose. One is if the pressure is too strong, straighten the hose out. Then the water won't break through the sides. And the other is to turn on the tap. Well, God turns on the tap, but we have to straighten out the hose. And that's the part of yoga that yoga plays. Kriya Yoga is particularly a great technique because it helps in this upward flow, helps to straighten that hose. And I won't go into detail right now, but if you want to achieve these things, yoga is a very helpful thing. Not Hatha Yoga, not the positions of yoga. They're superficial, they're helpful, but not essential. Meditation is essential, okay? Any other questions?
Hello? Oh, hi. Good morning, Swamiji. Thank you for sharing. Turiya is probably a little nervous right now. You mentioned talking about that you couldn't believe in a concept of a religion where, you know, that a god would put someone in hell because of, you know, their, you know, beliefs and, you know, the feeble mind, correct? Can anybody hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay.
He can hear you.
He said so far that you mentioned that you couldn't believe in a religion where God clapped people into prison for a few years.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I agree. It seems like it's a fear tactic of Christianity to sort of keep them in that religion. But then you talked about reincarnation, and once you hit that human level, that you can go backwards all the way to being a germ, you know, depending on, you know, your actions and what you do. And for me, I sort of am apprehensive about even that concept because it seems similar. That seems like a fear concept in itself.
Could you stop a moment so you can tell me?
The concept of God clapping us in hell seems like a fear concept.
Yes.
But he feels similar about the concept of regression back to a germ. It seems like a fear concept.
I agree completely. And there is an element of fear on the path. I was so scared of the thought of falling down when I was seeking, and I would, before I met Yogananda, and I would see the worst sinner and realize I could have made those mistakes. I could be like that. And that certainly is a fearful thing when you realize how easy it is. One little misstep can lead to another. Yes, there is an aspect of the spiritual path that does inspire fear. And we are driven forward by fear. We're driven forward by suffering. If all this world were just, everything were peaceful and beautiful, and we never suffered, very few people, if any, would seek God. It is through those things that we seek Him. The difference between that concept of God clapping you into prison and you going into prison voluntarily is what we're talking about here. You have chosen to go downward, and you can go as down as far as you want to until finally you say, this is just not what I want. And then sooner or later, you will have to turn back. And it's by your will that you find God. God puts out all the temptations, you might say, to seek Him. He puts out this desire for bliss in your heart, this desire to be peaceful and happy and so on. And He gives you that. And if you choose that as opposed to the other that makes you think that happiness is excitement, for example, gradually you overcome all these mistakes. But reaching the human level, it is possible to go in so many directions. And that's where the power of free will comes in. We have the power to either accept Him or reject Him. But it isn't God doing it to us. That was the point I'm trying to make. We do it to ourselves, okay? Any other questions?
Hello. Swamiji, there's a gentleman online that would like to know how to come to terms with the death of a teenage son. He understands it intellectually, but wants to know how to heal emotionally.
Dharma Devi asking on behalf of this gentleman how to come to grips with the death of a teenage son. He understands it intellectually, but how to do that emotionally.
Really, you can't do it easily emotionally. Of course you can't. It's necessary, however, to understand some things intellectually first. The truth is that boy came in with that karma, and we all come in with different karmas. You know, it's strange, but I got a prophecy in India many years ago saying that there was a danger of premature death. And it's true that three times in my life I came close to just dying suddenly like that. It was my karma. But I was out in the desert at 29 Palms and walking back to the ashram I was living in then. Suddenly a flock of crows flew around my head, and I thought, this can't be a good omen. 2 days later, when I went to make up my bed to go back to Los Angeles, I found a squashed black widow spider between the sheets. So that was one time I could have easily been killed, but there was Guru's grace there, which kept my life going. Another time I was in Puri, and setting up a microphone for a lecture, and Diamata was supposed to be talking. And all of a sudden, this current went right through my body, lifted me off the ground. I couldn't have let go of this because it tightens your hands, your muscles. But in that split instant, the fuse blew. And again, it took half an hour to find another fuse, but at least my life was spared. And the third time I was I bought a Lambretta in Italy and took that to India. And when I unpacked it, I had it there and I turned the key on, not realizing it was in gear. And here I was sitting on this thing, and suddenly it took off like that toward a brick wall. It was a brick enclosed courtyard. And I managed to figure out in that split second how to get into neutral and put the brake on. I stopped that close to the wall. So three times in my life, I could easily have been killed. It was my karma to be killed, perhaps. I mean, it must have been. But I had that divine grace that prevented it. So it says in the Bhagavad Gita, a little bit of the practice of this religion will free you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. It was a truth that in my case this worked out to be true. But it is true that we do have that karma. What causes it, we don't know. One thing you must always keep in mind, and that is that you will maybe lose the son, but he won't lose you. He's conscious. There's no such thing as death. Once you've passed beyond the portals, you know of every, you know you're still as conscious as ever, oftentimes more so. So try, instead of merely weeping and lamenting, try to contact his soul. You can do so. I don't say go to a medium, but in deep prayer and meditation, he may come to you in a dream. He may come to you when you're... But I know, for example, when my father died, I could feel his consciousness there. And it was just the consciousness of a young man again. He died at my present age. But it was the consciousness of that I had known when I was there, when I was a child. And full of energy and enthusiasm for life and so on. So really, there is no such thing as death. There's an appearance of it only. But what you lose is the body. The consciousness remains always there. And you put on garment after garment, but you're always alive. So yes, of course it's a great pain to lose your son. But it helps intellectually, yes. But in that intellectual help, you come to the point also where you begin to learn to accept. Without the intellectual start, you won't be able to accept. But to accept that this is God's will, and instead of lamenting him, which can hold him back, the soul is held back by the tears of the people it's left behind. But if you just bless him and try to help him in his onward journey, the more you give rather than taking, the more you feel free. So by giving love and wanting to help him, you'll gain. Whereas by lamenting his death, although it's a difficult decision to make, but be grateful for his sake. He's met his what he has to do. He is your son still. He will always be united with you if there is that bond of love now. Okay? Any other questions?
Me? I have a question on the subject of reincarnation.
Could you stand?
He is standing. He's in the light.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, I'll start again. My question is on the subject of reincarnation. And I want to know if during a human experience, if a person travels to a place where they maybe had a previous lifetime, would they feel anything?
You know, we do have places that we feel at home. It's strange. I went to the island of Bali many years ago in 1958. And when I saw the Barong dance there, I thought, I know this. It seemed very familiar. So we do tend to be drawn to places that we feel an attraction for, but we're not allowed to go only to that place. As Master put it, and I must say I was not pleased with his explanation, he said, otherwise we might find out too soon. And I thought, well, that's not fair of God to... But he wants us to seek him because We want him to. We want him, not because circumstances force us to recognize that there's no other reality. It's really a game. All I can offer you for consolation is that what I've said before, nobody who's ever found him has ever said, what a scam. They've always said it was worth every minute. But yes, you are drawn to such places. And when you travel, you may find that certain places, like that thing in Bali, you just know that you've been there before. And that déjà vu, people think of it as something sort of coincidental. It's more than coincidence. Okay? Did you have a further question?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
There's a question up here in front.
Yes. Just a moment.
My daughter passed away in 2009, and I've been grieving, and I am totally on board with learning everything intellectual and emotional to let her go on her journey and honor her karma, you know.
Her daughter died last year, and she's totally on board with trying to learn everything, both intellectually and emotionally, to let her go on in her journey.
And bless her. Pray for her.
I do, and I will more now that you spoke today to that. But part of me that is a recovering Catholic, and
she's a recovering Catholic.
Right. And so I'm willing to grow spiritually, and that the infantile, fearful part of me wants to hang on to the concept of heaven. I'm willing to let go of the hell part, you know.
when we love people, we can't help thinking of them with love. Just try to turn your love in a positive way. Say, yes, I miss you, but I want you. Be genuine. Be true to yourself.
Thanks.
Say, I do miss you, but I want you to be happy where you are.
And I want to know if you can give me permission to believe in heaven so I can see her again.
Will you give her permission to believe in heaven so that she can see her daughter?
I certainly do give you that permission.
Yeah.
You know, in one of the first prophecies that I had in India that were written long, long, long ago, but I won't go into that now. But it said that I spent a lifetime of 700 years in the astral world. And I have to say that that world, in a sense, has always been more real to me than this world. So, certainly, I do believe in heaven. And I believe that heaven hell also exists, but only in a temporary state. No one is ever condemned to hell for all eternity. That would be unthinkable. Yogananda told this story of one time he was visiting some fundamentalist Christian, and the Christian said, we're all sinners, we're all doomed to hell. And Master prayed, and he said, you have a son, don't you, who's giving you a problem? Oh, if you only knew. He said, well, he drinks, doesn't he? Oh, my God, does he ever drink? And Master said, well, I have a cure for this. And the man said, well, any cure you can give me, I'll be so grateful. He said, do you have an oven? Oh, wait a minute. He said, what are you getting into? He said, no, just I'm offering you a cure. Don't worry. He said, does it have a big door? Yes. He said, well, the next time your son comes home drunk, strap him up his arms, push him in the oven. What are you saying to me, my own child? I wouldn't dream of it. And Master said, if you would not treat your own son who deserves punishment to that kind of punishment, how can you imagine that God would do that? So yes, you can visualize your daughter in heaven. Not only that, but the more you send her joy and love, the more she will be attracted to that region. Okay, well, one more question, I think, is all we have time for.
Hi, good morning, Swamiji. At first I thought it was going to be a strange question for me to ask, but have the courage to. Talking about reincarnation, I understand what samsara is and, if you don't learn your karmic lessons, you move on. But what about the spirits that seem, the evidence that seems to show that there are still angry spirits here, or ghosts? What happens to them? Do they?
She understands about reincarnation and samsaras and that you move on. But her question is, what about spirits or ghosts that remain here?
You know, that some people, when they die, this world is so real to them that they stay on this level. Energy is directed by thought and willpower. And if that energy goes back to this world, there are such things as ghosts. Don't worry, most of them are benign. But I remember one time I was new on the path, and I'd never heard of any of this sort of thing. And it was absolutely fascinating to me. When I heard about disincarnate spirits, I thought, well, I'd like to know about this. And I still remember a dream I had. I was at a party, and then I said, it's time for me to meet a disincarnate spirit. And I remember leaving the party and entering a room. I can still see the floorboards. It was a barren room. And I went and stood in the middle of the room, and I said, all right, let me experience this. What is it all about? Suddenly I felt this, I heard this sound of Om, a very ugly aspect of Om, a lower aspect. And I felt my body going into sort of a strange state. And I found myself being sucked out the window. And I tried to fight it, and I realized this was a very strong force. I needed help, so I said, Master! And suddenly I woke up, and I asked him about it later. He said, yes, that was true. But if you cling to God, he will give you the power to free yourself from those things. But there are such souls as want to come back by shortcut into the human body. And they hang around bars and nightclubs and places where people sort of deliberately make themselves less conscious with alcohol. They hang around places where people are more open to that. But sometimes you will find people commit murder, for example, not because they did it, but some entity did it through them. You must realize possession is a reality. Ghosts are a reality. All these things you read about. But I would say don't dwell on that, because you attract what you dwell on. So try to think in terms of angels and high beings and God. Okay? Well, I think that's all the time we have for questions now. Thank you so much for coming. I'm very pleased to have been here. Out in the lobby or wherever it is, we're having refreshments. So if you want to ask me more, I'll be there. Okay.